The Guardian.
Order! Order!
The eyes to the right, 315. The nose to the left, 306.
Yes, he did it. Just. Gordon Brown scraped home to victory in the Commons on Wednesday night, where MPs voted to extend the pre-charge detention period for terror suspects to 42 days. But the Prime Minister only won with the support of the 9 Democratic Unionist MPs, prompting one old bird to tell me, this has the whiff of John Major. I'm Nick Watt and this is Politics Weekly. On today's show, we'll be asking whether the vote will give Gordon Brown a chance to relaunch his premiership after a series of recent setbacks. And a sad milestone was passed this week when 3 British soldiers were killed by a suicide bomb in southern Afghanistan, taking to 100 the number of British service personnel killed in that conflict. We'll ask whether British, American and other troops will ever succeed in Afghanistan. To discuss these matters, we are joined down the line from the Home Office by the Police Minister, Tony McNulty, who has been working round the clock to secure that vote on 42 days. I take it you are a relieved man, Tony.
I am relieved, but I know that there's a huge task before us. The vote last night was just part of the parliamentary process, and I have a real job to do both with the House of Lords and, frankly, not just with the 36 Labour colleagues who felt they couldn't support last night, but equally the other parties who I think now need to get on and discuss the details with us.
We have Shami Chakrabarty, the Director of Liberty, who has spent months trying to persuade Labour MPs to vote down the plan. You almost did it, Shami.
Well, not me. I mean, tributes to the brave Labour rebels who held firm. And I also want to say that I don't have any grudges against the others who were crushed down with all sorts of nasty practices in the last few days. You know, I couldn't do what some of these MPs do, which is to, you know, sometimes to balance reason and conscience against, you know, party loyalty and other pressures. But I think what I will say is that I saw the best and the worst of politics, and the best was the debate itself in the chamber. It was a privilege to be there. And I'm afraid that as all the papers, not just The Guardian that says it's a shaming victory, all the papers today pretty much say that the government lost the argument but won the vote, not in the chamber, but in the back rooms and the corridors of power.
And finally, we are joined by Tom Clark, the Guardian leader writer. Tom, the Guardian has been railing against these plans.
That's right. I mean, our view has been consistently not so much that these plans would turn Britain into a police state overnight or anything like that. They're a relatively incremental change. We're talking about a small number of people being held for a small amount of extra time. I think what's really wound us up, though, is the fact that these changes are unnecessary.
Well, we asked Simon Hoggart, The Guardian's parliamentary sketchwriter, to describe the scenes in the Commons during the vote.
Simon Hoggart, parliamentary sketchwriter for The Guardian, just back from the chamber where we've had the wafer-thin government victory over the 42 days detention without charge issue, which has created such a lot of ill feeling here. And it was a very, very passionate debate with some really ferocious speeches. Nearly all, it has to be said, from the people who are opposed to the government measures, including Labour MPs such as Diane Abbott, who made what was undoubtedly the best speech of the day.
This is not an objective, evidence-driven act. This is the purest politics. This is about the polls. This is about positioning. This is about putting the Conservative Party in the wrong place on terrorism. And I put it to colleagues that we shouldn't play ducks and drakes with our civil liberties in order to get a few months' advantage in opinion polls.
It was a very effective speech, and the Tory who came after her said it was the best speech he'd ever heard in Parliament. And you have to ask, what was it all for? Because it's unlikely to go through. The House of Lords will tear the thing to shreds, so will the European Court of Human Rights. The chances of it actually ever becoming law are almost non-existent, I'd say. And of course, one of the arguments the government actually had to use against its rebels was that it would never have to be put into action anyway. So you wonder, what was all that about? Well, it certainly created a tremendous parliamentary occasion. I noticed that Gordon Brown's briefing sheets have been covered in great black scrawls as if a furious spider had flung an inkwell all over them. And he actually came into the chamber after he voted to hear the result, that he was chewing his nails. I've never seen him do that on live television before. And you wonder, really, why was he expending so much credibility at a time when troubles are pouring around him, coming, as Shakespeare said, not in single spies, but in battalions. So it really has been one of the most dramatic days in Westminster for quite some time. Mr. Brown must be sitting back in Downing Street now wondering, well, I did awfully well, but to what purpose?
That was Simon Hoggett. Tony McNulty, not surprisingly, I'm going to turn to you first. So Simon Hoggett says the Prime Minister was chewing his nails in those final moments of the vote, and he asks, why did the Prime Minister bother doing that? Because the Lords will chew up your bill as well. Why have you gone to the wall on this?
We've gone to the wall on it because we think it's a very, very important provision. And bear in mind, too, that on Tuesday, and I fully appreciate why no one bothered covering it at all, I dealt with the other 91 clauses to the bill, many of which there is a broad consensus about. There is a debate and a contentious debate over coroners. But, you know, people need to ask themselves precisely your question, why bother? And we get these piffly little arguments about it all being triangulation and politics and trying to make others look soft on terror, which is just absolute nonsense. The Prime Minister needs this in the context of where we are now, like a hole in the head, except that he thought this was and is very, very important for the country, and that's why we pushed it and that's why we prevailed.
So you're saying it's an important provision, the Prime Minister believes it's important for the security of the nation, but you've watered down the bill so that some people on the harder line say this is sort of meaningless, and you've only won by offering concessions on completely unrelated area, like ending sanctions on Cuba. Diane Abbott, your Labour colleague, called this a grubby bazaar.
Well, Diane Abbott, I don't doubt Shammy Thorpe made a wonderful speech. I thought it was a very good speech, but number one had nothing to do with the bill, and number two had nothing much to do with the process of politics in the House, and I thought actually was a grubby little speech worthy of nothing at all terribly much. And I don't accept either this point, which I understand why she puts it, that somehow the crushed and the forlorn and the idiots are the only ones who can vote for this thing, and suddenly the 36 are brave, you know, sunny saviours of liberty, as characterised by Shammy. I just think that's a crass interpretation of what happened yesterday.
Shammy Chakrabarty.
Wow. Goodness me, he's come back. Look, can I just say that I have spoken to Mr McNulty about this bill over many, many months, and I've had proper, rational debate with him publicly and privately about the clauses of the bill. And there's no question that he's moved, even with the last-minute concessions, he's moved, but he knows, and I still think, this is a very bad, ill-thought-out, ill-judged bill, and that's on the detail. But I must respond to what he said about Diane's speech, which I think was the speech of the debate. Quite right that some of the things that she
just wasn't had, much to do with the bill.
No, it's a very good point, because actually a lot of what happened in the Palace of Westminster yesterday was nothing to do with the policy or the bill, but it was about the pressures that were brought to bear on members of Parliament to vote with the government. And I think that the public will thank Diane for that burst and injection of honesty into
of aspersions and suppositions.
I have to say, Mr. McNulty, that I have, you know, as you know, I have spent a lot of time with your Labour Party colleagues in recent months, because I have been meeting them one-on-one to discuss not extraneous politics, but to discuss this bill. You know,
as
I have.
As have I, but not at the same time, clearly.
No, clearly not. But what I'm saying is that from the conversations I've had, there were inordinate pressures brought to bear. There were threats and inducements and all sorts of pressures. And I think Diane was quite right to out them in the chamber, because she was calling on her colleagues to hold firm. And she was also giving the public, I'm afraid, an insight on the nastier side of, not you, Mr. McNulty, perhaps, but of your government and certainly the business managers. And I think the public do have a right to know.
Tony, can I ask you what you say about that point? You've said that Diane Abbott's speech was a grubby little speech because it had nothing to do with the actual bill. It was about the politics. But isn't the problem with your...
It had much to do with the politics either, to be honest. It was a flight of fantasy, as far as I understand.
Well, that's not my experience of talking to your colleagues.
But isn't the problem with your argument, Tony, that Gordon Brown was offering a series of inducements that had nothing to do with national security? Miners' knee compensation, sanctions being lifted from Cuba, all sorts of money being offered to Northern Ireland.
All suppositions and assertions. I don't doubt that there people will be crawling over the next 6-9 months of regular routine government business and finding everything but the second government on the grassy knoll. I don't doubt that at all. That's just the way politics work. It can't be right that every single person, and there were 304 Labour MPs as well as 11 from other parties who voted for this, that somehow doubt is cast on their integrity, but everyone who voted the other way was shining knights defending civil liberties. That's just not fair.
No, you're quite right, Mr. McNulty. Let's be fair on both sides, and I must be fair to you. You're quite right that a lot of people will have voted on the bill. And even people that I disagree with will have supported you and your policy. And frankly, as you and I have said to each other before, some would have voted, Mr. Field, for example, would have voted for 500 days, not 42 days. So there's no doubt that for some people, they voted, they voted willingly for an authoritarian policy, and it probably wasn't even authoritarian enough for them. I'm talking, and I think Diane was talking, about the people who were against this bill, the people in excess of 60, certainly before the local elections, who were gradually worn down and crushed down, even in the last couple of days, even in the last 24 hours.
Perish the thought, that they might have engaged with a discourse with people who support the bill and were persuaded by the force of argument.
Maybe
isn't
somewhere.
That just remotely a possibility?
Of course it is.
I don't cast aspersions at all on the 36 who voted otherwise. As I said at the top of the podcast, I feel almost that it's a failure on my part as the minister for the bill that I couldn't persuade them or many of them to come into the Labour lobby, and I have a real job to do there.
Tom, those exchanges between Tony and Shammy show passions are still running high.
They do, and I mean, I don't doubt what they both say, which is that there are some people on both sides of the argument here who are sincere in it. But I think what's troubling for a commentator looking at it is to see why have some people swung behind the government now? Is it the force of argument that's changed things in the last few weeks or months or even years since the vote on 90 days? And I don't really see much evidence that it is the argument. The person who's in charge of securing terrorist convictions, Sir Ken MacDonald, he's said that he doesn't need this power. The police haven't been able yet to find a case where they needed this power.
Because it's about the future, Tom, not the past. That's the whole point. And as for Ken MacDonald, he said quite fairly he's never seen any reason thus far to go beyond 28 days. And let me be even more candid. He said he can't really see much in terms of hypotheticals to go beyond it. And that's entirely his view. But he said equally fairly that it was a matter for Parliament to determine the law and the numbers and a matter for him and his team to implement it. But one of the real base things about yesterday was the way, by inference at least, David Davis and Shammy, I'm afraid, were talking about sexing up dossiers and evidence being available at 4 and 12 days, and by clear implication, attacking the police and the prosecution services for keeping people in 27 days.
Briefly, Tom, and then Shammy. Can we just have Tom and then Shammy?
Sure.
Well, I mean, of course, you can always dream up hypothetical situations where, in the words of Lord Stevens yesterday, it'd be nice for the police to have an extra power in their back pocket. But, I mean, our position as a paper, and I think the position of anyone of a liberal inclination, is to say that...
You can't say that either, Tom, to be fair. You can't put every single liberal or someone of liberal inclination on the side of... the Guardian's position. I don't think that's entirely fair at all.
No, I can't, but I can say that I think the idea of precautionary handing out of new authorities to the state, just in case they happen to be useful, is an illiberal way to proceed.
Fine, well, let's scrap the Civil Contingencies Act then, because that's precisely what that is.
Shammy.
Well, as for that, that's something that's only triggered in an emergency, which, of course, is something that...
It's still precautionary, Shammy, isn't it?
No, absolutely, yeah. It's precautionary, but it's not the ratchet. And what you're trying to put on the statute book last night and on an ongoing basis is the ratchet, where you extend pre-charge detention periods. In a sense, Mr. McNulty, you can't have it both ways. You have been very clear about wanting something for 3-9-11s on one day. Well, that would be the kind of emergency triggered in the Civil Contingencies Act. The Home Secretary and others, occasionally you don't talk so much about emergencies. You talk about needing more time for specific investigations. And as I've said to you before, you can't have it both ways. Is this an emergency power or is it a routine one? Lawyers that have read this bill, myself as a recovering lawyer, David Panic QC, has said this is not an emergency power. This is a routine one. On the sexing up of the
dossier. Says that the CCA is only appropriate on the better view, as unequivocally as you suggest.
Well, then, but if that's the case, then why not, as many members said last night, why not amend the Civil Contingencies Act?
We've repealed the provisions in terms of criminal procedures entirely. That was part of last night.
No, come on. You've wiped that away and replaced it with a routine power that's triggered by individual cases. Triggered by individual cases, not by public emergencies. But on this sexing up of the evidence, I want to explain my position because I do feel very strongly about this. I was on a TV programme last week with a cabinet minister who referred yet again to this idea that in 3 of the 6 cases where people were held right up until the 28-day limit, in 3 of those cases, the police were up against the buffers. Now, this is something that I've heard from Ken Jones at ACPO and others over many months of debating.
And Ken MacDonald, by the way.
People saying they were up against the buffers. Now, obviously, I don't have routine access to the files in these cases. But the day before yesterday, I spoke to a lawyer in 2 of those cases where we're told the authorities were up against the buffers.
Prosecution lawyer.
I'm not going to tell you what kind of lawyer, but perhaps I could just get this out. I spoke to a lawyer at length about 2 of those 3 cases and with others and really interrogated what was being said to me and was shown some documentary material as well that shows me that in 2 of those cases, the evidence on which the suspects were eventually charged was revealed, uncovered by the police at day 4 and day 12, respectively.
And you know the ins and outs entirely of the dynamics of the prosecution process.
Before we get too bogged down in a great legal
That's why I say that these cases have been erroneously and deliberately used to say we need more time.
Now, Shami, before we get bogged down in a great legal discussion, obviously Tony needs to respond to that, but I also wanted to ask Tony to look forward. This bill will now eventually go to the House of Lords. Are you really up for a battle with the House of Lords? Because they're clearly going to shred this bill to pieces. They'll send it back to the House of Commons minus the 42 days. There will be then the great process that we call parliamentary ping pong between the two chambers, and every single vote that you will have in the House of Commons, you will need those 9 DUP MPs.
Well, we'll see. I remain in consensus mode. I don't want the Lords to shred it. I don't want some big row with the House of Lords. I'd remind them just gently and the Guardian that we are the elected chamber and not the House of Lords. But I hope that common sense can prevail and we can get all of the bill through. Whereas I say, I think even in the Lords, some 80-85% of the bill will be, yes, discussed, yes, maybe amended in some ways to improve it, but we'll put provisions on the statute book that are positive all round, save for potentially, as I say, coroners as well as 42 days. So I don't want a row and I don't want posturing and grandstanding from the Lords, and I hope the common sense prevails.
And Shami, very briefly, round 2 for you with the House of Lords.
Well, absolutely. And all this stuff about democratic legitimacy is all very well, but in our system, we have independent judges. They can't strike down legislation, but we have this anachronism, if you like, where we have independent second chamber legislators. And if they have this, people have different views on the Constitution, but if the House of Lords exists to do one thing to preserve democracy, it is to safeguard fundamental rights and freedoms
there
in difficult times.
Liberty and the undemocratic forces defend democracy. Well done.
Heckling from... Well, it's a pretty topsy-turvy world when you need the DUP, Anne Widdecombe and Bob Spinks to bail you out of this shoddy detention plan.
Okay.
The minor matter of 304 Labour MPs. Please don't forget my colleagues, Shami.
Thank you for that. Well, Michael White, the Guardian's political commentator, asked a very simple question. So why did Gordon Brown do it?
I think probably because he wanted to show that he could be a tough guy. Tony Blair couldn't get 90, he'd get 42. And friends of his said to me, he has been persuaded by the arguments, you know. He's convinced we may need this. Do you remember he said at question time yesterday, the Glasgow airport case, where the baggage handler saved the day, involved some 2,000 computers and 8,000 disks and 25,000 pieces of evidence. Well, you can see the problem there. Question is, would his remedy have provided the answer? And listening to decent people, solid people, David Davis, Ming Campbell, Chris Hune, clever man, saying, no, this isn't going to work. It may even make matters worse.
So, Tom Clark, Mike White has spoken to MP saying that Gordon Brown did this to appear tough. But he looks terribly weak, doesn't he?
Well, I think that's it, and I think that's the tragedy of it. I think there were two political aims here. The first one was showing that Gordon Brown could get something through the House of Commons that, of course, Tony Blair had failed to. He'd failed in November 2005 with 90 days. Gordon was going to find a way through and show that he could deliver what Tony Blair couldn't. The second political aim was exploiting the uncomfortable position in public opinion terms that the Conservatives found themselves in. In a way, the government hasn't made much secret of that. Yesterday, Gordon Brown was at Prime Minister's Questions talking about constituency polls showing how many people supported him. And so he wants to put himself on the right side of opinion and David Cameron on the wrong side of public opinion. Now, the tragedy is that it's not really going to work for Gordon Brown this time. The response from the papers this time, if they've noticed it at all, which many of them haven't, as much as you might have thought, is phew, oh, Gordon's got away with it. Thank God for the DUP. It's not that he's delivered something. And of course, as we've been discussing, he may not have delivered it. He may not yet get it through because it has to go to the Lords and then back again and then potentially to the Lords again and then back again to the Commons. So it is about a show of political strength, but it's one that might not succeed.
So, Tony McNulty, it's not looking great, is it? Labour 23% in the polls. We had a Channel 4 documentary earlier this week in which we had cabinet ministers openly saying that the Prime Minister fluffed the non-election announcement last year. How much worse can it get for him?
Well, I think to describe Dispatches as a documentary is a bit highfalutin, if you won't mind me saying so. The trouble with Tom's analysis is that, with apologies, it doesn't stack up in terms of facts and chronology. We started the process of looking at all our counter-terrorism efforts in November 2006. We decided under Dr. Reid by March-April to go ahead with a bill, including some sort of temporary provision. I said to the Joint Committee on Human Rights that April that we were looking for some sort of portal or key to get through to emergency situations. So under Blair, this was decided long before Gordon took over the reins and Gordon pursued it. So, you know, nice little analysis, but doesn't stack up with the facts. Well, in the broader context, of course, we are in some difficulty. I know people are really feeling the pinch in terms of the economy. I do subscribe to the sort of Clinton-esque, it is the economy, stupid, and that's from where much of our malaise springs, because I think commentators are fairly clear, too, that while there's been a sustained short period of opinion poll leads by the Conservatives, that neither May the 1st nor May the 22nd with Crewe showed some wonderful flow of people all the way over to the Cameron-esque view of the world, because people aren't suckered in by such vapidity and PR spin.
Tom Clark, respond.
I mean, the thing that struck me as curious about the evolution of this policy is that, as you say, it can be traced back to 2006. But the oddity is that Gordon Brown, who was then Chancellor of the Exchequer, in 2006 was giving speeches and giving briefings about how what he wanted to see was an extension of 28 days, coupled to parliamentary oversight. You know, he hadn't at that stage, I think, worked out what parliamentary oversight would mean or how it would work. But it was an attempt to find a middle way, and he, as Chancellor, was putting that forward. Now, he was a busy man. He was Chancellor, he had budgets to write, pre-budgets to write, and yet he found time to kind of focus on this one issue, which, as you say, John Reid was also worrying about. And I think that was very clearly because he saw it as politically important, a dividing line that he could draw with the Conservatives, and something that he could use to show that he could succeed where Blair has failed. And
I think that's fiction, Tom. I really do. I say I've been at this 18 months before Jackie, before Gordon in his role as Prime Minister, and no one took me into a corner and said, oh, look, there's some wonderful triangulation opportunities here to really get the Tories on the back foot in terms of being soft on terror. That's just not the way these things work. I think very strongly that whilst that might happen as a matter of routine on most issues, it most profoundly doesn't on the counter-terror effort and national security.
Shami, just let
I
me ask you very...
differ, don't I?
Yeah. Shami, let me just ask you briefly on this wider question about Gordon Brown. Obviously, Liberty is a non-party organisation.
Right. Oh, obviously.
But how do you...
Oh, come on.
How do you see the future for the Prime
Mr.
Minister?
Mr. McNulty, we are a non-party organisation. If for years we were associated with the left and the Labour Party. I mean, Patricia Hewitt and Harriet Harman were probably whipping for 42 days last last night. Say whatever you like about us, but we are cross-party and non-party.
Okay, so you're cross-party, but tell me, how do you see the future for the Prime Minister, Shamit?
Well, you know, what do I know? All I would say personally, speaking personally, as me, a voter and a person, I had enormous hopes. I was very optimistic last summer, not just on the rights and freedoms agenda, but on a broader agenda, because of the breath of fresh air that I thought Mr. Brown would be. I believe that was shared by people, not just in and around the Labour Party or other parties, but just in the country, because, you know, after a decade, people are looking for a change. And at the moment, you know, this summer feels a long way away from last summer.
A grim moment was passed this week when three British soldiers were killed in a suicide attack in southern Afghanistan. This took to 100 the number of British military personnel killed in Afghanistan since 2001. Gordon Brown paid tribute to the soldiers at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday.
Mr. Speaker, before listing my engagements, I'm sure the whole House will wish to join me in sending our profound condolences to the family and to the friends of Private Nathan Cuthbertson, Private Daniel Gamble and Private David Murray of the Parachute Regiment, who were killed in Helmand Province, Afghanistan, on Sunday. The risks they bear and the sacrifices they have made are in our thoughts, not just today, but every day, and we owe them all a great debt of gratitude.
Tom, there was a lot of coverage of Afghanistan in The Guardian and other papers this week, but this is becoming a forgotten and misunderstood war, isn't it?
Well, I think it's certainly a war that's proving very difficult, proving more difficult than was expected. And there is a lack of clear understanding about what the objectives are. I mean, we've seen David Miliband this week talk in very strident terms about how it's equivalent to defending the White Cliffs of Dover. I don't find that very persuasive. I think, you know, there is an argument about security, and there is an argument about how if Afghanistan is allowed to harbour terrorists, that could have implications for Britain and for other countries, and that's something we need to worry about. But the idea that it's a clear and present threat isn't, I don't know, I don't think it quite will persuade people. And I think people are asking, why exactly are we there? Now, there might be some good reasons why Britain's involved in Afghanistan, but it needs to be clearer and sharper about what they are and also realistic about what it can achieve.
Tony McNulty, Tom Clark mentioned that interview that David Miliband gave to the Daily Mail this week about the White Cliffs of Dover. Do you see a link between Afghanistan and the 42-day plan? In other words, if we succeed in Afghanistan, we will help tackle terrorism, and maybe there's no need to have such draconian laws in this country.
I think Afghanistan's very, very important in that context, as well as what we're doing there, very, very important in terms of the people and government of Afghanistan as well. And I think it's a shame in many ways that it's conflated all the time with Iraq, as though the two and the genesis of the two are exactly the same. You know, I don't think anyone's calling for the Taliban to come back. But David's point, I think, about the White Cliffs of Dover was broader and was simply saying that globally now we are all living in a village, and things that happen in one place can have a huge impact on another. People will know that what's happening in the Fatah area and Waziristan and places in Pakistan does have a very real bearing on much of what constitutes the threat in this country, and activity there can impact directly here. But I think that's he meant that in the more broader sense. Let me give you one small example, not related to war or military action at all. I went up and did a meeting in Dewsbury with the Pakistan community at the behest of Shahid Malik. And amongst other things, there was a real issue there about young Iraqi Kurds, refugees, asylum seekers, and the impact on the local young Pakistan community. And I was thinking in the back of my head that if we were doing, if a couple of things worked in a positive sense in terms of the peaceful provinces in the north of Iraq, more young Iraqi Kurds would go back to Iraq, and that would diminish the struggle and communal strife between young Kurds and young Pakistanis in the middle of West Yorkshire. So we really are, whether in security and terrorism terms or more generally, in mostly very, very positive ways, a global village. And this distinction, which I think is what David's point was, between the cutoff of the domestic and internally focused and the international and global, is simply disappeared.
So, Shami Chakrabarti, we are a global village. What happens in Iraq, what happens in Afghanistan really matters here.
Well, that's undoubtedly true to some extent, but that doesn't mean I like the White Cliffs of Dover analogy. I mean, from my perspective, I think once you invade a country, whether you do it rightly or wrongly, you have a certain responsibility for the clean-up and to leave something sustainable behind, responsibility to the people there. And I think Mr. McNulty's right that that to lots of, whatever you want to call it, liberal, progressive opinion, Iraq and Afghanistan are two separate cases that sometimes wrongly get conflated. This is my own view. This isn't Liberty's remit at all. But there was greater justification after 9/11 for some kind of pursuit of those responsible, perhaps into Afghanistan. It perhaps could have been something more targeted. But that's all for the past now. The bottom line is there is a responsibility to protect and to sustain something that might approach democracy in Afghanistan. And one can't just walk away when it becomes difficult. Though I have to say that the price to British troops is significant, to their families. And having met with the Royal British Legion the other week, I really do hope that the government looks very seriously at its responsibilities to those coming back from both of those conflicts and their families.
Absolutely.
Well, on that note of consensus, thank you all very much. That's it from this week's edition of Politics Weekly. Thanks to all my guests, the Police Minister Tony McNulty, the Director of Liberty Shami Chakrabarty, and the Guardian leader writer Tom Clark. Politics Weekly was produced by Francesca Panetta. I'm Nick Watt. Join us again next week. Till then, goodbye. Thank you, everyone.
Cheers. What enormous fun.
Thanks.
Thank
Bye.
You.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.